A fresh round of warnings this week about the state going any longer without a budget. Hint, the forecasts are not good. State Treasurer Mike Frerichs, a Democrat, says Illinois' credit rating could take more of a hit, making it even more expensive to borrow. And he went back to the 90s, quoting a former governor to criticize the current one.
Governor Edgar said, "I don't know how you can run a state without a budget." And that is the number one priority responsibility of a governor here in the state. So I would say this is not a partisan attack.
So it's getting hotter in Springfield. But how close are we really to a budget? We'll find out. Plus, a town in southern Illinois is grappling with a housing crisis like no other.
You are about to destroy a whole community. Is that weighing on you guys' conscience?
No.
And finally, everything you think you know about who eats fast food may be completely wrong. I'm Nova Safo. That's all coming up on the 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nova Safo in for Nyla Boodoo. We're going to start the show talking about the state budget crisis. There are things happening on multiple fronts. Members of the state House are trying to reach a deal with the governor. Over at the Senate, Democrats and Republicans are seeing if they can compromise on a partial budget. And just to keep things interesting, brand new developments this morning with a nonpartisan watchdog offering a scathing budget analysis. You still with me? Don't worry, if you're not, we're going to sort all of this out with our weekly panel of political reporters. Joining us from the State House, Monique Garcia of the Chicago Tribune and Brian Mackey of Illinois Public Radio. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. This is not the first time for either of you on the 21st, but it is my first time. So bear with me as I try to get a handle on what's going on with Illinois politics these days. Brian, let's start with you.
Three hours?
We have about 15 minutes, so we'll see what we can accomplish. The Civic Federation issued a scathing report this morning. Can you tell us what it said?
Yeah, it basically says Governor Bruce Rauner's budget proposal, which he issued several months ago, is wildly out of balance. There's not really much that's particularly new about that analysis. The governor had it right there. There was a line that said, you know, it said, I think, negotiating on a grand bargain, but it might as well have said, you know, fingers crossed, hoping that the Senate can come up with some deal to save, you know, or come up with $4.6 billion. So, you know, just yet another voice in the chorus of people who say that things are looking dark here in Springfield.
And saying that the backlog could mushroom to $20 billion in unpaid bills. Is that right?
Yeah. And up from there, I mean, it's, you know, depending on how high tax rates, you know, how eventually people are either going to have to, you know, I don't know, empty the prisons and shut down state government and you know, close state universities, which doesn't really seem like a realistic option. Taxes are probably going to have to go up. I mean, that there's seems to be bipartisan agreement on that, even though not everyone will say that as enthusiastically as other people. And so, the longer that decision is put off, the greater the deficit and backlog of bills is going to be.
And the Civic Federation made it very clear in this report that there aren't any easy answers here. So they go on to criticize the governor's budget, but they also offer recommendations on a path forward. And none of these things are pretty. It's talking about a pretty major income tax increase, which the Senate is discussing, though not as quite as high as they want. They're also calling for a spending cap. And they say, you know, this has been a spectacular failure and we cannot continue to go on like this. And they warn lawmakers against passing stopgap budgets or one-time spending plans to perhaps keep the schools open because they say that relieves the pressure to get something done. And now is the time to do that.
And yet a partial stopgap budget is actually being considered in the Senate, right? Monique, what's happening
there?
Well,
there was a stopgap or a lifeline. It depends on the terminology you want to use that passed the House last month. That would provide a little over $900 million for universities and for social service programs. So it was sent to the Senate, and right now it's just kind of chilling there. And that's because senators on both sides of the aisle, Republican and Democrat, are really hoping to revive this larger so-called grand bargain. This would hopefully end the impasse. It would call for income tax increase. It would call for new taxes on services. It would also perhaps have gaming and also borrowing to help pay down the backlog of bills. It would also have some things that the governor has pushed for, like a workers' comp reform, and also changes to some maybe procurement laws. So, you know, it's kind of the whole kit and caboodle. But those talks stalled earlier this year, in part because the governor got involved and said it didn't have enough parity is the word that he uses. He says that if we're going to ask taxpayers to pay more, we also need to give them some kind of relief. And he's pushing mainly for a property tax freeze. So people have in the last week really tried to rally around this grand bargain again in the hopes that they can do that instead of a lifeline budget.
And why are things kind of ramping up all of a sudden now?
Well, we're hitting the end of the month deadline. So this is the traditional time of the year where everyone kind of scurries about and tries to get a budget done. After May 31st, the vote threshold goes up and it becomes much harder to pass a budget. Not to mention, we haven't had one in 2 years. So it's a pretty dire situation. So we kind of have this last few weeks here where everyone's running, not always in the same direction, but there is a lot of action. And so it's kind of hard to keep track of everything that's moving. And things change here very quickly. So even as we're talking, there are talks going on, and what we're telling you right now may not be the case here in a day or two.
Or even maybe at the end of the segment.
Possibly.
Brian, over to you. It looks like a lot of the onus right now is over at the House, and Speaker Mike Madigan, the Democrat, of course, had a lot to say about this yesterday. He announced something. Can you tell us what that announcement was and what it means for this negotiation process?
Yeah, he basically said that he was going to appoint a group of his sort of trusted colleagues to try and negotiate with the governor on what he's called the governor's non-budget issues. But he also said that he hopes the governor would focus on the budget. As whenever the speaker speaks, you have to sort of put on a set of those jeweler's loops, right? I'm thinking of those really thick glasses and try and read between the lines to figure out exactly what he's saying. And, because he's very careful and very precise in his statements. And, wow. You know, as a lot of the Republicans pointed out, the leaders, that this is sounds a lot like what we've heard from the speaker in the past, which is let's focus on the budget. And, you know, the speaker has as much as the governor has invested in making House Speaker Madigan the root of everything that is wrong with Illinois government in terms of advertising and his messaging, coordinated messaging over the last few years, the speaker has been pretty quiet and behind the scenes this spring. He has not done a lot of press. I mean, last year there was a point where he was, or maybe it was 2 years ago, where he's holding news conferences every week. He's really kind of laid back and let the Senate, take center stage and let the governor take center stage. And as we're getting to the end of session here, people are trying to turn attention back to him. There was talk of a group of people in the House who are going to encourage the Senate to keep working on their grand bargain.
Right. And that's a bipartisan group that's come out. They actually put out this statement this morning saying, you know, please work. We want you to work. There's not a whole lot of talk going on here in the House. And we're encouraged by you in the Senate doing something. And we hope that you can kind of lead the way here, because the concern is that should the Senate pass something, it'll go to the House and simply languish there. And there won't be any action, because ultimately it does take two chambers to get a bill on the governor's desk. And then you have the question of what the governor will do. And sometimes his public statements don't always match up with his actions. And he has surprised even his own Republican members and budget action he's taken before. So there are a whole lot of players here who need to be working towards the same direction.
Speaking of going back to Speaker Madigan for a second, you guys talked about him calling it non-budget issues, some of these priorities that the governor has. What exactly are those specific issues that Speaker Madigan is alluding to that he wants to, I presume, set aside and talk about the budget separately from those issues?
Well, so Governor Rauner has long said that Illinois needs to be competitive so it can be compassionate. That's one of his bits of messaging he's used. And by that, he means changing the workers' compensation laws. In the past, it's also included things like changing the civil litigation laws, making it so it's a little more difficult to win lawsuits and cracking down on trial lawyers, sort of. It's also included parts of his political agenda, like term limits and changing the way legislative districts are drawn in Illinois. And the governor has basically made adoption of those things basically a precondition for him negotiating on the tax increases that he himself has said would be necessary to balance the budget in the short term, at least. And his theory of that case is basically, I guess, what you know was once derisively referred to as trickle-down economics, right? But you increase the economic activity in Illinois and tax revenues will become a thriving state. Tax revenues will be flowing in and we'll be able to have such low tax rates because the business here will be so great. That's basically the governor's theory of the case. Any benefit from that would seem to be years and years off. The administration has not put a lot of emphasis on quantifying the benefits of that. It's really hard to say, you know, how does putting term limits on, how does that help the budget situation now? Whereas you pointed out that, you know, the backlog of bills is $13 billion and going plus. Up and up and up.
Yeah.
You know, how does that help now? Well, the governor says, well, I'm in this for the long term. And, you know, he said, we got to have short term pain for long term gain.
And the governor says also that we have to project to businesses that things are changing in Illinois. And he says that will give them the confidence they need to invest here. But the speaker has long not been convinced of that. He has, as you noted, calls them non-budget issues. At one point, he and Democrats had said that the governor was holding the budget hostage for these sorts of things. So they're not convinced, A, that it will help the budget, and B, they say that a lot of these ideas will hurt core constituencies of Democrats. They say workers' comp rules will hurt unions, and that this is about the governor really trying to dismantle the middle class to the benefit of corporations.
And when it comes to the budget itself, you guys are alluding to the fact that there are certain things that are now on the table. There's an income tax hike on the table. There is a corporate tax hike on the table and certain amount of cuts. Do we know how much those hikes are, where they're going to hit, and where the cuts are going to come from?
Well, all of this stuff is very fluid. As of yesterday, I think that the Senate was considering raising the personal income tax rate of 3.75 up to about 4.95. That's under the 5% level that it was when Rauner came in and let the tax rate roll back. There's also some talk of expanding taxes on certain services that currently aren't taxed, like going to the barber. And there's also kind of this broad idea of cuts. So part of the reason that the grand bargain stalled earlier this year was because Republicans said there weren't enough cuts in this and that we're raising taxes willy-nilly, but we're not doing anything to tighten our belt here. And so Senator Bill Brady from Bloomington is pushing for about $5 billion in cuts. Now, whether or not Senate Democrats will agree to that is yet to be seen. It's very difficult to convince some members of the Democratic caucus to vote for raising taxes and then also vote for making massive cuts.
And we've had sort of de facto cuts to higher education, to human services, because Illinois has gone so long without a budget. We've seen agencies closed. Hundreds of people have been laid off at state universities. So I think Democrats argue we've cut enough in the last 2 years as it is.
Indeed, Democrats say that that was part of the governor's strategy, that this was his way to force some cuts kind of through backdoor efforts.
And you guys read my mind. Do we know who's hurting the most right now and who will hurt if we, you know, that maybe isn't being hurt now if we don't have a budget come 23 days from now?
Well, I mean, I think who's being hurt is human services is one area. Higher education is another. Now I work for my radio station where I work is a licensee of the University of Illinois, and the U of I happens to actually be one of the has a lot of external money that doesn't come from state government, so it's hurting the least. But we've seen Chicago State University's enrollment plummet. Other state universities' enrollment has plummeted. Northeastern Illinois University has had to take a number of furlough days this year. We've seen credit ratings downgraded at many state universities. And then on the human service side, drug treatment centers have closed. Domestic violence shelters have drastically scaled back hours. The pain is being felt quietly, sort of below most people's consciousness, but it's being felt broadly across the state of Illinois.
There's also a question, though, of state government and how it operates. So other things that are not currently funded include the prisons agencies and Veterans Affairs hospitals. And right now, they've been in kind of triage mode. They've been able to provide services. There haven't been giant riots, and prisons haven't yet run out of food. But those are very concerning issues that could eventually come to the forefront. Whether or not that's enough to finally create some momentum, we'll have to see.
Do we know yet who's feeling the brunt of the political blame from this? Who are voters blaming for this impasse that's now 2 years in the making?
I think that there is probably plenty of blame to go around, and that is why you see these kind of last-minute efforts at the end of session for both sides to say, look, we're trying to do something. The governor, of course, is trying to put all of that blame on Speaker Madigan. He thinks he's been pretty successful in that effort. He notes that Democrats lost a few seats in the House last fall, which has eroded the Speaker's grip. But Democrats are also looking towards the next gubernatorial election and saying, look here, the governor doesn't have anything to show for his 2 years in term. And he's been fighting us, and there's still no budget. And there's only one thing that's changed, and that's the governor.
And do we have a sense of now that they're talking, but yet the main basic large issues haven't changed? Do we know these latest rounds of talks? What is the likelihood of their success? In the last 30 seconds, Brian, you have the floor.
Well, I guess the short answer is no, but we have another 25 seconds to fill. look, I'll say this. I mean, people want to, as Monique said, people want to sound optimistic because they don't want to wear the jacket for this, but positions are hardening fast. The governor has already sent an email to supporters saying he protected them from a tax increase, and yet a tax increase is an integral part of these negotiations. How do you reconcile those two things? And that's part of the political difficulty in actually achieving any sort of policy resolution in the next month, or frankly, the next 1.5 years of Governor Rauner's term or first term.
All right. We'll have to leave it at that. Thank you both very much. Monique Garcia of the Chicago Tribune and Brian Mackey of Illinois Public Radio joining us there. Up next, why are hundreds of residents of public housing in one southern Illinois town being forced to move? You may not believe the answer. We'll learn more about that coming up. Stay tuned. This is the 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, generating new knowledge and developing and evaluating new technologies and methodologies to better distribute scholarly knowledge. The University Library at Illinois.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nova Safo, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. Right now, hundreds of families in the southern Illinois city of Cairo are trying to figure out where they're going to live. That's because federal housing officials are shutting down their public housing complexes. The buildings are to be torn down. They're in terrible condition. Residents say they've been neglected for decades. But the people who live in them are being told they'll most likely have to move out of town because the Department of Housing and Urban Development can't find new housing for them in Cairo. Residents are not happy, to say the least. They say the feds don't care about keeping families in the city they've called home, sometimes for generations. There is a lot of emotion and heartache tied up with the story, as you're about to hear. Federal officials met with Cairo residents last month, and it didn't go well. Here's a sample.
You all have made a conscious decision to destroy this community. We understand that. But you're going to put these people out of their homes, offer them a little voucher and tell them to go somewhere, you're about to destroy a whole community. Is that weighing on you guys' conscience?
No.
That's pretty difficult to hear. That's Gary Woodfield. He's lived in Cairo his whole life. Says he's a grandfather, and says his grandfather helped build the public housing buildings. Reporter Molly Parker from the Southern Illinoisan recorded that audio, and she joins us now. Molly, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, good morning. Thank you.
Thanks for being here. We're also joined by Cairo City Councilwoman Connie Williams. Ms. Williams, welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Molly, let's begin with you just so we can get a brief overview of what this is all about. How did we get here? How did we get to the point where people are not only being asked to leave their public housing apartments, but they're actually being forced to leave the city they've known for sometimes generations? What's happened here?
Well, there's been a lengthy number of years of mismanagement of the Alexander County Housing Authority, and that began to come to a head in 2014 with some reviews, civil rights violations cited, other mismanagement, misspending of funds cited by HUD, leading up to last year in February of 2016, HUD seizing control of the Alexander County Housing Authority, removing the board and the executive director, and running that housing authority under federal receivership. They held that under receivership for a year without any major changes. They did do a few things, tried to eradicate bugs, though they didn't make a lot of progress there, but largely didn't really show their hand as to what they were going to do. And then finally, after just over a year had passed, held a meeting in April and informed residents that they would be issuing vouchers, and that while they would try to keep as many residents as possible in Cairo, they said that the reality was that they were not building new housing, and therefore they assumed that many families would have to relocate to other communities.
And Molly, what has been life like inside these complexes? You've been there. Can you walk us through how bad is it there?
Well, I have been there. It's not the same as living there, but what I have observed is the infestation problem is extreme, and it's not due to tenant, you know, lack of cleanliness. Most tenants, in fact, work extremely hard, harder than most of us, you know, feel like we have to. You might leave a dish in the sink or something on a normal day. They have to be extremely judicious about picking up everything. They have to put their food in sealed containers, or the bug problem will multiply: infestation, mice, rats, you know, all sorts of bugs. And again, it's not about cleanliness, and it's not in all of the units. And it may be, you may be an extremely clean tenant, but if you have one or two other tenants in your nearby complex, that could affect your housing. And as much as HUD has tried to eradicate those pests, they've had a hard time doing that.
Yeah. And Ms. Williams, to bring you into the conversation here, on the surface, at least on paper, it kind of looks like HUD is doing the right thing. It's saying people shouldn't live this way. They're giving people vouchers so they can live anywhere they want. But when you dig deeper here and on the ground there in Cairo, the story is very different. Can you help us understand how Cairo residents are reacting to what's happening, what HUD is doing, and why it's having the effect it is there in the city?
Okay. Yes. You know, on the surface, you're right. It does seem like they're doing the right thing, because we don't want citizens, we don't want anybody to live in these apartments, because they said they have outlived their usefulness, and they haven't been well taken care of because of neglect and because of issues with management. And but when you get right down to it, people have lived here, you know, grew up here, born and raised here in Cairo, and they're not interested in leaving their hometown. Cairo is a small community. It's a close-knit community where neighbors help neighbors. You know, your child is out, and we, you know, it's a neighbor season. You know, we just take care of each other. And so people don't want to leave that. And with what HUD has done, they have to bear a major part of the responsibility for the way that these apartments are, because they were sending inspectors here every year for as long as I can remember. I was born and raised in Cairo. I only left to go to college, and then I came back home and worked in the school system for 34 years. So, you know, but as long as I can remember, HUD was sending inspectors here to take care of these apartments, make sure that things were getting done the way that they should be done. And then to find out that people are living like this, it's horrible. And HUD has just, like, turned their backs on people. You know, you can give someone a voucher and say, okay, you got to move in 30 days or 120 days, which is what we were told in the beginning. They would have up to 120 days, starting with the vouchers that would be given out at the end of this month, so that they could be relocated and in time to put their students in school. But that also affects our school system. It would take about half of the students out of our school system as well, which would almost demolish it. So it's, on the surface, it may look okay, that HUD is doing something good, but they are really destroying our community. They're being a part of destroying the community.
And when you say destroying, I understand Cairo is a town of about 2,500 folks, and this could affect 400 people. Is that right?
Right.
So it's a big chunk of your community, and I understand in your school system it could be half the students in a class.
Right, exactly. So that means, you know, no, there's no school system. Who's going to want to stay? You know, that would mean that other people may have to leave to educate their children as well if we can't maintain the school system. And with just 200 students left in the district, and that's from preschool through 12th grade, it would be devastating to the community.
Now, Cairo is a river town right at the southern edge of Illinois. I know you guys have been trying to kind of revitalize the city. Can you give me a sense of what this does to those efforts?
Well, right now, we are considered a food desert because we do not have a grocery store in town. It closed down a couple of years ago, the only grocery store that we had. But now we have another Harvest Markets from out of St. Louis. Ready to open a store here, and I think that will go forward. That they're still planning to come to town, even if this happens. But it would be so much better if all of our citizens were here. You know, they're going to target the surrounding areas as well. And so, beginning maybe the 1st of August, I'm thinking that we will have a grocery store in town. There are a lot of companies who constantly call City Hall, you know, requesting information about Cairo in order to develop jobs here. So, yeah, we're looking to keep developing things in the port. This is going in the wrong direction because, you know, we're taking so many people out of town.
Yeah.
You know, it could affect, you know, the growth.
Molly Parker, back to you. I know that the Department of Housing and Urban Development has not been deaf to these concerns. They have been responding, talking back to residents, trying to give them more information. What has HUD been saying in response to the residents' concerns?
Well, HUD's response is that they have tried and that they don't have the funds to give them what they need. I think to Councilwoman Williams's point is, while that is perhaps what they're saying, there's also some questions about, well, if HUD was responsible for oversight, if HUD allowed the mismanagement to go on because they did not respond appropriately once there were concerns flagged, which there are records that indicate that they had indications of that dating back to at least 2010 and possibly earlier. When I interviewed the executive director and the only time we were able to sit down, he since refused to talk to us in the fall of 2015, he even said, well, I've been doing it this way for 24 years. Why are they just now getting upset with me?
You're talking about how he's been handling the properties and where the millions of dollars HUD sent them went for maintaining these properties.
Sure. And to Councilwoman Williams' point, that they were to come down on a regular basis for inspections, and they never told him anything was wrong. If they did, it amounted to a strongly worded letter that eventually they were able to turn their backs on. So I think that's the argument. But to your point about what they have said is that they are not deaf to their concerns, that they are, the woman who's been assigned down there, Tawanda Macon, has said that this was the last thing she wanted to say, but that her administration, her organization, HUD, was not going to provide the funding to build new.
Ms. Williams, I know a group of sixth graders at Cairo had a letter writing campaign aimed at Ben Carson, the director of Department of Housing and Urban Development. Can you tell us what their message was to Mr. Carson?
Well, the message was the same as what I've been saying. This is their hometown. They're young. This is all they've ever known. And even the students who do not live in the housing project feel like they're going to be affected. You know, everybody is sad. Everybody is hurt. Everybody is afraid. And they shared that very well with the secretary. to whom, to which he responded to them, I thought was very, very uncaring, in a very uncaring way. Hmm. Just my opinion, a very uncaring way. Well, you know, keep your memories in your, you know, keep your memories, and that all, Carol will always be home, and you can always remember that. But there's nothing that we can do. We have to get you out of there. And that wasn't appropriate for sixth graders. I mean, it was just, to me, it was a cold letter. And, you know, and he's just saying, you know, in my words, not his words, in my words, well, you know, so be it. You know, you're going to move anyway, so whatever. Hmm. And that's the way I'm taking it. He did not say it in those terms.
Yeah.
But that's what it meant to me, and to a lot of the people in the community, that's what it meant. And we were all really offended by it, and so were the children. So they immediately started thinking, okay, well, what else can we do? Who else can mm-hmm. we talk to? They just, you know, passed it off like, okay, he's not going to help. Who else can we talk to?
Hmm. And Molly, when HUD says there's nothing we can do, why is that? Can you help explain the structure of public housing financing these days that is really kind of hamstringing HUD's ability to kind of, say, just rebuild another complex right there in Cairo?
Well, as I understand it, I don't want to present myself as an expert on HUD financing, but in my conversations with HUD officials, they have talked about that they rarely build new out of the ground alone. HUD no longer just makes a singular federal investment into new housing, that they typically work with private investors and public-private partnerships. In Illinois, there's the Housing Finance Authority. And frankly, Councilwoman Williams probably knows way more about this than I do, but that, and I think those conversations are ongoing about tax credit mix and private developers. What HUD has relayed to me is that in their efforts to secure that kind of deal, that they have not so far been able to lure a private developer to Cairo for that type of mixed use or mixed income apartment complexes that you might see going up in larger cities with more diversified income base of those seeking to live in some sort of subsidized housing.
And Molly, there are other similar complexes that are fairly older, you know, aging in other parts of Illinois, aren't there? And this could this presumably is something that other communities could be facing down the road?
Well, I think that's a very fair point. While Cairo is having to face this unfortunate housing crisis in their community right now because HUD looked at the situation and finally took action because of you know, how egregious it had gotten, not only with the housing conditions, but with the sort of outright misspending, what appears to be just outright misspending of funds and lack of concern for what was happening there by the past managers. I think that Cairo is not unique, that there are many communities, including in Southern Illinois and elsewhere in Illinois, that are facing similar problems. And I would just like to make a quick note about mm-hmm. what I think is part of why Cairo is being dismissed largely by many officials in this case, is I believe that if this were happening in an area where legislators had to regularly drive by or drive through Cairo on the way to Springfield or on the way to Chicago, where they meet to make these kinds of decisions in Illinois, or if you regularly had federal officials driving through Cairo, this crisis would not be allowed to unfold the way it is. Mm-hmm. Cairo is located at the bottom tip of Illinois. Unless you're going there purposefully, you don't pass through there.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of it. I think that's part of what's going on. And it's been a slow moving crisis. This is not a hurricane hit. And, you know, now we're having to deal with this. This has been going on for decades.
All right. We'll have to leave it at that. Ms. Connie Williams, a city councilwoman from Cairo, and Molly Park, a reporter at the Southern Illinoisan. Thank you both so much for spending a few minutes with us.
Sure thing.
And you're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nova Safo in for Nyla Boodoo. So here's a pop quiz for you. Who do you think eats the most fast food? Now, you're likely to assume it's people looking for a cheap option, right? Well, a new study from Ohio State University and the University of Michigan has found something completely different. And in a little while, we'll speak with nutrition experts Lisa Young and Mike Roussel. They'll help us figure out how to eat fast and healthy. So stay tuned for that and send in your questions via Twitter or Facebook. On Twitter, we're at 21st Show and our Facebook page is The 21st. But first, more on that surprising study. We're joined by Jay Zagorski of Ohio State University. Hello, Mr. Zagorski.
Hello, Nova. Thanks for having me on the show.
Our pleasure. Don't leave us in suspense. Who eats the most fast food?
Actually, the middle class are the ones who eat the most, but there's almost no difference between the poor, the rich, and the middle class in eating fast food. Basically, everyone eats fast food in the United States.
We're all eating it. And I understand the difference between low-income residents was what, like 80% of all low-income folks you surveyed, 75% upper income, 85% middle class. Is that right?
That was what we found. We found there really wasn't much difference. The poorest 10% based on income, 80% ate fast food at least once in our survey period. The richest 10% people, 75%. Not really a very large statistical difference between the richest people in the country and the poorest people.
All right, so if money isn't the reason people eat fast food, then what is it?
Well, a lot of it seems to come down to convenience. People who ate fast food tended to be living in, like, cities, for example. People in urban areas ate much more fast food than the people who lived in suburbs. And compared to that, even more than people who lived in the rural areas. So convenience is clearly a factor.
So it's the way we live that has to do with whether we're going to be eating fast food or not, the amount of time we have, et cetera.
And speaking of time, we also looked at people who are workers and also how much time they had. And the more hours you work, the more likely you were to be eating fast food. Workers seem to be eating somewhere between 15 and 18% more fast food than non-workers. And when you worked a lot of hours, every extra 100 hours you worked seemed to be about a 0.5% increase in the number of fast food meals you consumed.
And we know that Americans eat a lot of, not eat a lot of hamburgers, but Americans work a lot of hours. We sometimes don't even take our vacations like we're supposed to. What does this say about culturally where we are right now as Americans?
I'm not sure what it says culturally about us for being Americans, but our culture seems to suggest we eat a lot of fast food because we don't have a lot of time to sit down for home-cooked meals.
Yeah, those are kind of going away, aren't they? I certainly am not sure my cooking would be something I'd serve to other people. What is the goal of your survey? What are you trying to achieve in terms of the end goal here?
Great question. Patricia Smith and I, we've been working for over a decade in trying to understand obesity and health issues. And one of the key points that we've come across is that there's lots of misperceptions when trying to understand health, nutrition, weight, and all the interactions between them. As an example, a couple of years ago, we did a study that looked at the freshman 15, which is how much weight gain people get the first year of college. Everyone assumes you go off to college, you gain 15 pounds. We actually found it was 2 to 3 pounds was really the correct number. And it's sort of like that in this particular study. There's been a lot of people who assume that poor people eat a lot of fast food, and that's one of the reasons why poor people have higher body mass and lower health outcomes. And it was even back in 2008, Los Angeles came out and said this very explicitly. They were trying to improve health in poor neighborhoods, and they banned fast food restaurants from opening up in South Central and other parts of Los Angeles. So they were very clear. They said, you know, we're seeing a lot of fast food restaurants in poor neighborhoods. We don't think this is a good way for poor people to be eating, so we're going to ban all new fast food restaurants. And what our research really suggested, this is a very misguided approach. We're not trying here to push fast food in any way, shape, or form, but what we're trying to point out in our research is that everyone eats fast food. This is not just the type of food that poor people eat. It's the type of food everyone eats, from the richest to the poorest in the United States.
And hopefully with better data, there's better policy that comes out of that with time.
Hopefully.
All right. Professor Skorsky, we have to leave it at that. An economist from The Ohio State University, thank you so much for joining us today.
Have a wonderful day.
All right. Now, if fast food is going to be a part of our lives, I'd like us to maybe take a few minutes here and figure out how we can make healthier choices with a couple of experts on nutrition. Joining us now is Lisa Young. She teaches about nutrition at New York University and is author of the book, The Portion Teller. Dr. Young, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined by Mike Roussel, who teaches nutrition at Penn State and contributes to numerous publications, including Men's Health and Shape magazines. Mr. Roussel, welcome as well.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, and if you have questions that you'd like to ask our nutritionists, now is the time to send them in via Twitter or Facebook. On Twitter, we're at 21st Show, and our Facebook page is The 21st. And also, you can reach us the old-fashioned way, that thing called a phone. Our call-in line is 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. Mr. Roussel, let me start with you. How easy is it to make healthy choices when it comes to fast food? The way we live today, we live busy lives. Fast food is just a part of that. How easy is it, though, when we have to go fast with our food to make healthy choices?
Well, I think it's simple, but it's not necessarily easy. You know, I think when I was a kid growing up, like, fast food restaurants were basically just burgers and fries, and there are a lot more options nowadays in the spectrum of what would be considered fast food. But it's just, when you go to those places, are you going to make the decisions that are going to be good for your body, or going to make the more nutritious decisions, or are you going to pick the foods that you're kind of craving or really want to eat? That's really kind of the crux of the decision that you have to make with fast food.
And Ms. Young, what say you? Walking into a fast food place, how easy is it to make a good decision?
No, I would actually, you know, agree, because technically you can try to do the salad and the grilled chicken and get this on the side and that on the side. But again, when we go in here, we're lured partly by quickness and speed. So having a salad could be complicated and not as easy. And we're also lured by prices and by big sizes. So often for the same price, if you can get five hamburgers or one salad and you're feeding a family or you're going in with kids, you often opt for the thing that's not healthy. And the other piece is, there's more unhealthy things than there are healthy choices, that making it easier to unfortunately make the unhealthy choice.
And Mr. Roussel, do you concur with that? Is it a question of what's on the menus? Is it just that we have far fewer choices for healthy than unhealthy when we walk into not just a burger joint, but a Subway joint or a quick salad place even?
Yeah, well, I think that there are a lot of choices, and I think, if, you know, when you were talking about the survey showing that basically everyone eats fast food and people that work more tend to eat more, in those situations, what I've found, even with my client base, is that they're going to these fast food restaurants, and if they're working a lot of hours, maybe they've missed a meal, so they're hungry, they're tired, they're stressed, and that sets you up to make a poor food choice. Kind of all those things are like a physiological storm to help you make not the best decision. And if you have this overwhelming number of options that are going to lead you towards the higher calorie, unhealthy choice, then that's probably where you're going to go, unless you're very focused and really committed. And it's hard to do in that environment. Even a place, like you said, like a salad place, you might go to like a fast food salad place, but you'd be surprised how fast calories can add up when you're adding nuts and cheese and salad dressings and all kinds of other things. So you really need to be vigilant, and I always recommend that people plan ahead of time and try not to make the decision in the moment, because that makes it a lot harder.
And Lisa Young, do we need to expand our definition of what is fast food? Just consciously, we walk into these various places that offer us food quickly. Do we need to start thinking, oh, this is really a fast food place? I may not even just to change our frame of mind as when we walk in there?
I mean, yes, because you could argue that something like pizza is fast food, or just going into something place quick and getting food quickly could be fast food. There's fast food casual, you know, so it isn't just the places like a McDonald's, which, believe it or not, they have the smallest portions of everybody. You're probably in better shape there, than you are in Burger King or even Chipotle. You know, the thing about some of those other places are that you can have more healthy choices, which is nice.
And it's not and yeah. What you're talking about there is with portion sizes, it's not just the ingredients themselves, it's the amount of food we're talking about, right? It's changed over time, and we may not have realized that we're eating a lot more calories.
No, absolutely. I mean, from my research, and as I illustrated in my book, The Portion Teller, is portion sizes have increased, you know, 2 to 5 times since the 1950s. And so what that basically means is that a burger is not a burger. I mean, a Big Mac is small now relative to the doubles, the triples, you know. And so what's happening is same thing with fries, same thing with sodas. I always suggest to clients, whenever you go into these places, get the smallest size available, because there could be double or triple the calories in the larger size. So a burger is not just a burger.
And Mr. Roussel, when I walk into Burger King or one of the other burger joints and I order a chicken burger instead of a regular burger, should I feel as virtuous as I do when I do that?
No, you probably shouldn't feel as virtuous.
Uh-oh, that's not really what I want to hear.
When it comes down to it, if you were get chicken on your burger instead of a beef patty, you know, the contribution of that beef patty or the chicken is actually relatively smaller than you think compared to the caloric milieu of the burger and the sauce and the cheese and everything else that gets kind of piled on. And, you know, kind of talking about how portion sizes have increased and you need to go smaller. People generally have a very hard time estimating the calorie content of a portion and what is an appropriate portion. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes in these fast food settings, it's even harder because there are things that have been added that you're not necessarily aware of, or the caloric content of sauces. And so you really do need to be very vigilant about controlling your portions and not thinking that one little switch is going to all of a sudden make it fine to do.
And Lisa Young, what is a good portion? What should we be aiming for?
You know, we should always be aiming for, in these places when you're eating out, it's always the small. So, you know, in terms of the protein, you probably want to eat your palm's worth, which is like sort of like a deck of cards. If you're a bigger guy, 2 decks of cards or 2 palm worth are fine. But we're often getting, you know, 5 or 6 palms worth in terms of, you know, the protein.
You know, I got to say, when you say a deck of cards worth of protein, as in a deck of cards size, meat portion, for example, that sounds so little to me. I mean,
let me tell you something. That's because our social norms have changed. We used to have a situation where we'd only have a Big Mac or a single hamburger, which, believe it or not, is that size, if not even smaller. But when you're bombarded with all of these doubles, triples, and bigger sizes, it sort of makes the tiny thing, the norm, look tiny. Same thing with soda.
And so what is the proportion in terms of a deck of cards of meat? And then what else should be on that plate?
4 decks of cards.
I'm sorry?
You want to have, you know, 1 to 2 decks of cards as opposed to, you know, 3 to 4 decks of cards.
And then what else should be on the plate?
Well, I'd like to see half your plate salad and vegetables or fruit, which is not always the easiest thing when you're out unless you order the salad.
Uh-huh. And Mr. Roussel, you know, one of the problems with this is, you know, sometimes we may think we're eating healthy. And it's tricky because, for example, a lot of people think if they go to a chain like Chipotle, which offers healthier ingredients, antibiotic-free meats, that, you know, they're making a healthy choice. But they might be mistaken, right?
Yeah, so I think that's a great point. And I'd like to bring the attention to there's a difference between wholesome and nutritious. And so I would categorize wholesome as it's an antibiotic-free meat, or it's organic, or it's local. Like, these are all good, wholesome qualities, but that doesn't necessarily make them nutritious. Like, they could still have high amounts of sugar. They could still have high amounts of fat. You know, you could still have high amounts of calories. So even when you're going to a place like a Chipotle or a Moe's, like a burrito place, and you're thinking, these are some nutritious, wholesome choices, you really need to be careful what you're putting in your burrito or what you're putting in your salad, because it's going to be 1,200 calories before you even realize it.
Well,
and
with that,
so you need to be your advocate. You know, you need to be your own nutrition advocate.
All right. With that depressing thought, we're going to send everyone off to lunch. Mike Roussel of Penn State University and Lisa Young of NYU, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
All right.
Oh, you too. Have a great day.
Thank you. That's all the time we have today, obviously. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. And if you have Alexa, we're easy to find. If you have NPR One enabled, tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, and every other way to contact us via phone, email, social media is on our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Christine Herman and Alan Montesilio. Abrar Alhiti is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. I'm Nova Safo in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.